Hello, this is David Greenwalt of Club Lifestyle. In this exciting interview, you're going to hear me speak with Dr. Lauren Cordain from Colorado State University. Dr. Cordain authored two excellent books. One is called The Paleo Diet. The other is called The Paleo Diet for Athletes. In this interview, you're going to hear me speak with Dr. Cordain about Paleolithic eating. What is Paleolithic eating? How can it benefit us? How is it an excellent, excellent program to live on? And how can we make it not a diet or think of it as a diet? And what exactly is it? All of these questions and a whole lot more are about to be answered in my interview with Dr. Lauren Cordain. And now I present to you my interview with Dr. Lauren Cordain on Paleolithic eating. Hello, everyone. This is David Greenwald of Club Lifestyle. Today I have a very special guest with me. His name is Dr. Lauren Cordain. Welcome to the program, Dr. Cordain.
Hi, David. Good to be here.
Dr. Cordain has written two outstanding books. One is called The Paleo Diet. The other is called The Paleo Diet for Athletes. And that's what we're going to be talking about here today. Before we get into all of that, Dr. Cordain, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, age, family, education, experience, that kind of stuff?
Sure. I'm 55. I'm married to Lori. We've got three sons. Kyle's 14, Kevin's 12, Kenny is 8. Got a bachelor's in health science from Pacific University in 1973, master's in physical education from the University of Nevada, Reno in 1978, and I took my PhD at the University of Utah in health exercise physiology. I've been employed here at Colorado State University as a professor since 1981.
Outstanding. Well, you've got a ton of experience, and the books reflect that, no doubt about it. Well, what we're talking about today is Paleolithic eating. And let me ask you, what created your interest in Paleolithic eating?
Well, I've always been interested in exercise and health and eating properly, and probably like some of your older listeners and readers, I think what we thought was healthy eating back in the 70s and 80s is perhaps different than what we thought now, and I think we thought healthy eating was plant-based, low animal foods, and lots of starches, lots of whole grains, and so forth. I read a paper in 1987, Boyd Eaton's seminal paper, Paleolithic Nutrition, that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1985. And I read that paper, and I thought that was just about the best idea I'd ever heard on nutrition and health and well-being. And that's kind of how I got into this whole thing, was just reading all of the cross-references to that paper and organizing those cross-references, and end up with tens of thousands of papers. I finally gave Dr. Eaton a call at Emory University. We had a good chat on the telephone, and at the end of the chat, he offered me a real compliment. He says, "Well, it sounds to me like you know more about this than I do." So I had him invite him out here to Colorado State, gave a talk, and one thing led to another. We started writing papers together, and I guess the rest you can say is history.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's outstanding. And it's neat, you know, because in the 80s, like you said, we were pitched heavily that, high carb, and grains, of course, being the primary carb source, were the way to go. Low fat, high carb.
Yeah, that's right. You know, brown rice, beans, typical vegetarian fare, we thought that was the healthiest way to eat. And, I think 20 years later, we've come to the conclusion that that may be healthier than the standard American diet, but it certainly is not the optimal human diet.
Well, I'm sure you've been asked this many times before, but let's just get this out of the way. What is the answer to the people who have a strong religious faith who believe there simply was no Paleolithic era?
Well, you know, I think you've got to respect everyone's personal belief systems, and I think that if you turn them off to a healthy way of eating and a healthy lifestyle because of the philosophical and ideological arguments, I think that's not a good thing. So, I think however people want to view it in their own perspective, they can view it that way. But the bottom line is we need to get them eating healthier. And the types of foods that we recommend, the types of foods that our Stone Age ancestors ate, lean meats, fruits, vegetables, fish, seafood, these are the types of foods that bring us health in the modern day. So respect those belief systems, but let's get everybody back to a healthier way of eating.
Okay, great. And you did touch on it a bit, but let's slow it down just a bit and give a little more clarity to what exactly the food types are that are paleo-friendly.
Well, you know, I think one of the interesting things is anybody, any of your listeners or readers, if you just think about it kind of critically, you can think about the types of foods that we didn't eat. Obviously, we didn't have technology in the Stone Age, so any processed foods were out. Anything that comes in a can, a package, or a box was not consumed. And then, surprisingly, some of our staple foods that we think about, like dairy products, they didn't eat them as well. And this is a no-brainer. Any of your readers who are hunters realize that it's very difficult to approach a wild animal, let alone milk it. So
yeah.
You can't milk a wild animal. So the only way we could have had dairy products is after we domesticated animals, and that was occurred 10,000 years ago. So that's why dairy products are out. And then grains are virtually indigestible without grinding them and cooking them. And the fossil record, we don't find these crude grinding stones until about 10,000 to 15,000 years ago. So in studies of modern-day hunter-gatherers, grains were only used as starvation food. So the staple foods, dairies and grains, were not part of it. Salt was not part of it. And basically the staples were the wild animals they hunted, the fish that they could fresh fruits and vegetables that came into season that they could gather.
Is there a, let me just ask you this too, because I just thought of this and I meant to ask you earlier. What period of time is the Paleolithic era?
Paleo means old, lithic means stone. So this is the old stone age, and it is the first appearance of stone tools in the fossil record, which occurred 2.6 million years ago in Africa until the beginning of the agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago.
So the Paleolithic era is 2 million years ago to 10,000 years ago?
2.6 million years ago to 10,000 years ago.
Wow. That's quite a period.
Yeah, that's a very long period. And the period in which humanity has adopted agriculture is just a drop in the bucket. We've been on the planet for 2.6 million years, yet the foods that we eat, the modern-day foods, only came in within the last half a percentage of the time we've been on the planet. So we're genetically adapted to foods that we have hunted and gathered for those 2.6 million years.
Wow. Well, do you believe that we Americans are basically eating ourselves to death?
Yes.
And if so, then why are we so inclined to eat high-fat, high-carb meal combos? Why do we seek that food out constantly?
Because we're hardwired, our genes seek those foods out. We have factors in our taste buds that tell our brain that these foods taste good for us. And in the Paleolithic era, there was survival value to finding fatty foods or foods that had a sweet taste to it. Fatty foods generally were calorically dense animal foods, and sweet foods were usually fruits or vegetables. And so there was survival value to getting those, but we didn't have those foods all the time. We couldn't get them on a daily basis. And secondly, we had to expend energy to obtain energy, whereas in this day and age, these foods are not an asset, but they're a liability because we can get them anytime, all the time, and we don't have to expend energy to obtain energy. So we can throw anything into our shopping cart, and this is the primary problem.
We've got the Paleolithic genes in a modern age, and they aren't serving us very well.
That's right. And what we need to do is we need to correct that by trying to make our environment more like the environment in which we evolved in. Let's take the best of that world and use it and leave the worst behind.
What do you believe is the greatest cause of America's obesity epidemic today? Is it activity? Is it food? Is it a combo? Or which one, you know, if you're on a teeter-totter, which way are we tilted?
Well, clearly it's a combination, but if you have to choose one first, if you have to order them, food would be first and then exercise second. Studies, long-term studies of overweight individuals show that exercise is an inefficient way to lose weight, whereas reducing your caloric intake is really much more effective.
And I know that in the research, which you know you're very well aware of too, it seems like they really it's pitched that you know the exercise is important all along the way, but it's even more important in the maintenance phase, it seems, for people
that
are...
That's right. That's right. That's where exercise really comes in. Exercise isn't going to help you lose weight, per se. What it's going to help you do is to keep the weight off. So once you've lost the weight via diet, primarily, then exercising is going to help you keep it off. And exercise is also beneficial in that it changes all kinds of risk factors for chronic disease that we have. So it improves just about everything that's wrong with you. And so we're definitely advocating exercise. But in terms of the obesity epidemic, we believe the primary factor is excessive caloric intake via these very delicious type foods, food combinations that didn't exist in the Stone Age, combinations of fat and sugar. That's a combination that simply does not exist in any natural food.
And you're not, I know you're not suggesting, because you're extremely active, you're an athlete, aren't you?
Well, I was. I'm getting to be up in the years these days, but when I was in college, I was a college track athlete, and I've been active, and I've ran and swam most of my life.
And even when during the process of weight loss, just for example, just for clarification, you do suggest that people exercise.
Oh yeah,
okay.
Absolutely, sure.
It's just that the food is we're going to be on a teeter totter.
You're not going to lose weight by going out and running 3 miles a day, day in and day out. It's just not going to happen. And this is just pure math. If you look at the amount of calories that it takes to lose a pound, there's roughly 3,500 calories to lose a pound.
Right.
And if you look at the amount of calories that are expended by going out and exercising for, let's say, a 45 to 60 minute period versus the amount of calories that you would expend if you hadn't exercised, it would take you about, probably 30 to 40 days to lose a pound. And for most people, that simply is not psychologically gratifying, and they would go off of it. So exercise by itself is a poor way to lose weight, and anybody can do the math in terms of the caloric changes that occur. And it's really, you can easily cut your diet by 500 kilocalories a day, and you can do the math. You can see in seven days you can lose 1 pound. So it's simply a mathematical deal that we're up against.
Well, you know, and at a practical level, too, something that I teach all the time for my my club lifestyle members is that, you know, exercise is important all along the way, but keep something in mind. If you exercise for 60 minutes and you burn somewhere between 400 and 600 calories, that took you 60 minutes to do, and it's important, and there are tons of health benefits for doing so. However, if you come back in the home, any of us could easily eat 600 calories in 5 minutes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So it's
all right.
Yeah, exercise is good for us, and it helps us to keep the weight off. But to get it off in the first place, we need to reduce our caloric intake. And one of the best ways to do it is to eat high protein foods. High protein foods have much more satiety value than either fat or carbohydrate. And they also have what's called a thermic effect. And when you eat protein, it elevates your body 2 to 3 times, your body metabolism 2 to 3 times greater than either fat or carbohydrate. So that's why replacing carbohydrate or fat with lean, high-protein foods like what our Stone Age ancestors ate, this is why it's such a good strategy to help people lose weight. Numerous studies have shown that if you give people a high-protein meal, like, say, at lunch, not only do we eat less calories during the high-protein meal, at the subsequent meal, at dinner, we eat less calories as well because we're not as hungry in between meals.
What's your statement to the people who say that we should not be consuming more than 15% of our dietary intake as protein because of kidney issues, and we've got blood acidity issues, or we've got, you know, whatever else going on? What's your statement to that?
Well, there's no precedent for that in with modern-day hunter-gatherers or with Stone Age people. In a number of our scientific papers, we've looked at the range of macronutrients, and it was never as low as 15% if it was possible. The range was always between 20% and the physiologic protein ceiling, which is about 40%. So we believe that that's the range. In terms of the kidney issue, it's a non-issue. A colleague of mine in Copenhagen, Arne Ostrop and his group have actually looked at kidney function with and without high-protein diets. And even though we have what's called an increased glomerular filtration rate, meaning that the kidney is working harder to turn over the blood, what happens, the kidney works just like a muscle. It's getting exercised, and the overall mass of the kidney changes. So the glomerular filtration rate per mass kidney remains constant, and we don't see albumin spilling out into the urine, and so that's a sign of kidney dysfunction. So high-protein diets don't cause that. We don't see the albumin in the urine, and we don't see any change in the GFR when we look at it in terms of the total kidney mass.
Any issues, while we're on the subject, any issues at all with regard to calcium, with regard to high protein intake?
Yeah, it's been known forever and a day that protein causes an increased calciuresis, but this is something that has really been a hot topic in the scientific literature the last 4 or 5 years, and what we're finding is that through other mechanisms, high protein diets actually increase bone mineral mass. We think it may be an IGF-1 effect. So there's enhanced calciuresis, but there's also increase in bone formation. And what you need to look at when we look at calcium homeostasis, we need to look not how much is going out. We need to know how much is coming in and the difference, the balance. And that's really what's critical. It's like your bank account. It's not how much is going out or how much is coming in. It's the balance. And what we're finding is that calcium balance in high-protein diets is improved. And mechanistically, we still haven't worked out how that works. But it would seem logical based on what our Stone Age ancestors were eating. They never touched milk. And we know from X-ray studies of their bones that they have very powerful, strong, robust bones, and they never drank milk their entire life, and they ate a heck of a lot of meat.
That's just outstanding information. It really clears up things, especially getting it from you, cutting edge, brand new. It's just that's outstanding. Thank you for that. I got to ask, how can you compete with McDonald's and Krispy Kreme with regard to getting people to change? I mean, we are hardwired to seek those types of foods, and are we just too hardwired to eat those calorie-dense foods for any of us? I mean, to really save us in mass?
Well, you're right. I mean, we are hardwired to seek out fatty foods, salty foods, sugary foods. And again, I mentioned that those foods had survival value in our Stone Age environment, whereas now they are a liability.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're talking about, David, are behavioral issues. And for everybody, we have different crutches that they have to use to overcome those behavioral issues. And, you know, in my book, I give a few strategies for how to overcome this. We have what we call the 85-15 rule. And I think it's more important what you do 85% of the time than what you do 15% of the time. And many people can have very beneficial health effects can be accrued by following this diet 85% of the time. You don't have to be 100% compliant. First, the best way to get people to give up on any diet, and this really isn't a diet, it's a lifestyle plan, it's a way of eating for your lifestyle to improve your health. The best way to get people to give up on anything is give them a thou shalt not. And as soon as you say you can't eat donuts or a pizza for the rest of your life, they're not going to do it. And so I think by giving them the flexibility to go out on a weekend with friends and have whatever they want, they know that those foods are still available to them. But I think what they find after they do this for months in, months out, year in and year out, they find that these foods make them feel so rotten that they really don't look at them as reward foods anymore. And I'm probably one of the first people on the planet in the Western world to be doing this type of eating. We did it way before it was ever popular back in the early 90s. And to my way of thinking, when I think about healthy foods now, I'd much rather have a bowl of fresh blackberries or raspberries, some sliced avocados or steamed tiger prawns than a combination of white flour, white sugar, and hydrogenated fats. You can call it a donut, a pizza, a cookie, or cake, whatever you want it. But that food isn't appealing to me anymore after having been doing this for more than a decade.
You know, food addiction is massive, and the longer I coach in the weight loss and lifestyle area, the more I see food addiction as a massive force in the lives of people that are my clients. You know, in my professional experience, you know, I've heard of a few people who claim they're addicted to certain fruits, but you know, I've never met anyone who is truly overweight, who exclusively eats a true Paleolithic meal plan. So what I wanted to ask you is, what's your experience with Paleolithic foods as they relate to food addiction and being over fat? Do you know anyone who eats paleo exclusively who's overweight?
When you ask people that are overweight or what their favorite food is, or people that are typical Americans that don't think anything about their diet, it typically comes down to some sort of fat, sugar, salt mixture.
Right.
And these type of mixtures, again, as I mentioned, are impossible if you eat real food. So it's very difficult, David, to overeat steamed broccoli and salmon. It's almost not going to happen.
You're going to fill up too fast.
That's right. You're going to get, there's two things that are going on here, is that real foods have a much greater, the calorically much less dense than our processed foods. So broccoli and carrots and tomatoes and cucumbers and all these things that are good and healthy for us, they take up a tremendous amount of stomach volume, and so we're going to feel fuller on those. And then lean protein foods, we can't eat unlimited lean protein. You can easily eat five candy bars, but I doubt that most people could eat five skinless chicken breasts. So you stop, because protein is much more satiating and it's much more filling than are these processed foods.
And let's face it, the real foods take longer to eat.
That's right. I mean, if you get a carrot in front of you, you know, you have these fast food eating contests where people stuff 35 hot dogs down their mouth.
Yep.
I doubt that those guys could stuff 35 carrots down their mouth to save their lives.
We wouldn't be able to do it on a television program, that's for sure. we'd have to use the slow motion photography or something.
Yeah, I mean, you get hung up after about halfway through the carrot. You can't get it down.
That's so true. Well, the shift from paleo eating to our modern style, why did this occur about 10,000 years ago? Why did we shift?
Well, those are kind of complex issues.
Okay.
And if you go to my website, www.thepaleodiet.com, mm-hmm. you can actually read a scientific article called The Origins and Evolution of the Western Diet, Health Implications for the 21st Century.
Okay.
And if you download that, that explains all the why behind it. But it's complex, and we don't have all the answers of why we started this agricultural revolution. But it has to do with the extinction of large mammals and the increasing human populations and also this protein ceiling. And so cereals were a good way to get around the protein ceiling when large animals became extinct.
When you say protein ceiling, you mean that there wasn't going to be enough protein?
No, there's a human physiologic protein ceiling, despite what bodybuilders or weightlifters may tell you. You can't eat more than about 40% of your total energy is protein. We simply lack the enzymes in our liver to get rid of protein, and we become toxic. The protein becomes toxic, and we get sick. And so this is called rabbit starvation. The old-time frontiersmen knew that if they were out in the dead of winter and all they could eat was lean protein, they'd be in bad shape. So we just can't eat unlimited proteins, and we've documented what that ceiling is. It's about 40% of calories. So you either have to have fat or you have to have carbohydrate. You can't just eat lean protein.
Got it. I've got a few questions that my members submitted, and let me do the first one here. Here's the first question. A member wrote, I realize there's some professional controversy about this, but what's your best estimate of what Paleolithic people were eating macronutrient ratio-wise, and how does that compare with any recommendations in the book? And if there's any difference, why?
Well, I think that, people, lay readers, when they don't actually get into the scientific articles themselves, so we never came up with one number. I mean, and I don't know how that's been bandied about. There was always a range of macronutrients, and those ranges varied from season to season, from locale to locale, from person to person. So that was the key issue that we made in the scientific papers, is that there was a range. And our bottom line is that the modern range falls outside of any range that we would have seen in Stone Age humans. And so that is the more important issue. And the idea that we eat a lot more carbohydrate and a lot less protein than we are genetically programmed is the take-home point.
What is the range for each of the macronutrients, basically?
Well, we believe that the protein range was probably between 20 and 40% of total energy. And then depending upon what season it was, whether it was spring, fall, or summer, the balance was made up by either carbohydrate or fat.
Okay. And typically, what do you see, what do you like to see with regard to the carbohydrate and fat percentages?
I think it varies. I don't think that there is one number. I mean, like my friend Barry Sears, he's giving you 30-30-40 or something.
Right.
I don't think that you need to be that strict about it. I think you need to follow your appetite and by eating healthful fats and healthful carbohydrates and making a concerted effort to get lean proteins in every meal, it comes out in the wash. And so I would say that, if I had to put a number on it, it's going to be between 20 and 30% protein probably. When you start getting up over 30% protein, I think you start to, in many people, you start to encroach this physiologic protein ceiling. And then if you eat healthy fats, if you eat monounsaturated omega-3 type fats, I don't think people have to worry about how much fat they get in their diet. And if you eat low glycemic load carbs, you don't have to worry how much carbs you're getting.
And it's going to be pretty tough, as you said earlier, and this I've also found to be true. It's simply pretty tough to eat true Paleolithic foods, to overeat, I mean.
Right, and it's very difficult to get much more than about 30 or 40% of your energy as carbs from Paleolithic type fruits and vegetables. You just simply, you can't get more than about 30% of your 35% of energy, which we believe is helpful. You should try to get as much as you can. And that, you talked about acid-base balance. If you get roughly 25 to 35% of your energy from fruits and vegetables, you don't have to worry about calciuresis from too much protein. And so that's another factor involved.
Let's go to the next question from a member. The member writes, how can paleo-style eating fit into a bodybuilding nutrition program? And is it possible to make substantial muscle gains eating this way?
Yeah, there is, and in our most recent book, The Paleo Diet for Athletes, we explain the physiologic basis for why these types of diets are ergogenic, why they cause muscle mass to the increase. One of the major effects is what are called branched-chain amino acids. This is valine, leucine, and isoleucine. These are three amino acids that in the last 5 to 10 years scientists have found directly switch on genes that promote muscle synthesis. And if you look at the typical athletic diet, it's overloaded with grains and processed food. Let me give you a for instance here. If you look at whole wheat, if you take a 1,000 kilocalorie serving of whole wheat, it only provides you with 6 grams of these muscle-stimulating branched-chain amino acids, whereas conversely, 1,000 kilocalories of lean beef gives you roughly 35 grams of branched-chain amino acids. So I think we kind of went overboard in the 70s and 60s and 70s when we started advocating high-starch, high-carb diets for our athletes at the expense of lean meats and fresh fruits and veggies.
Outstanding. The next question goes to flax oil. The member writes, I've heard that flax oil is not suitable for cooking and can create toxins when heated. In your book, I noticed that many of your recipes include flax oil. Can you shed some light on this? To cook or not to cook with flax?
Yeah, that was a mistake, and we readily admit that. And if you go to our website, under our FAQs, we give you the reasons for why that mistake was made. It has to do with some scientific articles that evaluated whether or not oxidation occurred in flax seeds as opposed to flax oil. And if you could take flax seeds and heat them up to 600 degrees for 2 hours, there's no oxidation of the alpha linoleic acid. And so we interpreted that meaning also flax oil, but that's not the case. So we've corrected that mistake, and in the second book you won't see that. You can also go to our website and find out the details on how that mistake was made.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And then another question is, would a person be able to understand the concept of the paleo diet by purchasing Paleo Diet for Athletes, or should they read just the paleo diet first?
Oh, either way, you know, I mean, I think if you want to save yourself some money, you can just go to the website, www.thepaleodiet.com, and you can get most of the information there. We modified the diet slightly so that muscle glycogen stores can be fully compensated. None of our Stone Age ancestors would have ever run day in and day out for weeks on end, months on end. They simply wouldn't have done that, and so they were more reliant on what we call intramuscular triglyceride for their endurance. So they had very, very good stores of intramuscular triglyceride, but they didn't have a whole lot of glycogen simply because they didn't have high glycemic load foods. But we know that in order to get the last drop of performance out of athletes, you've got to have muscle glycogen stores tipped off. And so in the new book, we've made modifications so that people can top off their muscle glycogen stores. We've done it with healthier carbs than what the athletes are typically eating. Most athletes eat a lot of junk and high sugary foods and refined carbohydrates, refined grains, and we're recommending high glycemic load carbs that are net base yielding, things like potatoes, sweet potatoes, yams, bananas, and so forth, dried fruit. These are better choices.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is, it just came to mind, is I do find that when I turn clients who are struggling a bit with their weight and they are what I call a weight fighter, and we're wanting to break them through a plateau, and I have them go to more of a paleolithic eating plan, they see right away that they can have nuts. And one of the things that I do find that they can overconsume quite easily are nuts. Do you have any thoughts on that or comments?
Yeah, if you look at nuts, they would have only been seasonally available to most Paleolithic folks, so they would have had a ton of them as kind of feast or famine, but they would have never had them all year long. And I can't remember if it was in the first book or the second book, we actually caution people on nuts. One of the reasons for it is that all nuts have extremely high omega-6 to omega-3 ratios. The only exception to that are walnuts, with probably, I think, there's about 6 to 1 or so. And a very good way to get your diet off base in terms of the proper N6 to N3 ratio is to OD on nuts or seeds. And if you combine those with dried fruits, which we do in what we call trail mix, that's a real good way to have modern-day paleo diet. But things like dried fruit and nuts would not have been available in unlimited quantities year-round to our Stone Age ancestors. Their only staple food was lean meat.
Well, I definitely caution my clients, because I've seen it be very problematic for them.
Yeah.
They'll consume, instead of what the label would say is a serving. You know, they eat, you know, six or seven servings quite easily.
Yeah, you can pound down 2,000 or 3,000 calories in nuts.
Yep.
Without anything whatsoever, but it's very difficult to pound down that much lean protein. So,
right.
I think that's for beginners on this whole concept. Is that nuts aren't taboo, but again, nuts are one of the ways in which you can defeat the purpose of this diet.
Well, you've already kind of covered one of the questions I was going to ask, which relates to how you've made an allowance for the athletes in the new book, The Paleo Diet for Athletes, on the carb issue. And as you already explained, just to kind of make sure that we have this clear, it's to help make sure that glycogen stores are maximized for optimal performance, correct?
That's right. And, you know, you actually can, if you're judicious about the whole thing. There's a fellow who won the Ironman. His name is Gordo Bryn from New Zealand. He's got his own website, and he's a, you know, one of the better known triathletes in the world right now. And he's pure paleo, and he's making it work. I don't know specifically how he's doing it, but I think he's doing lots and lots of fruits, dried fruits, fruit juices, and so forth. So he's pretty much making it work with some of the non-paleo type foods. But again, it's kind of what I mentioned early on, is that you can accrue much of the health benefits of this diet by being about 85% compliant. And particularly people that are athletic and very, very active, I think that some of these non-paleo, some of the higher glycemic load carbs are not going to influence their metabolism in an adverse manner because of their high activity levels, whereas people that are overweight or insulin resistant, which is two-thirds of the American population, they need to be real careful and cautious about eating higher glycemic load carbs.
Well, you know, there are going to be some long-distance athletes listening to this who are going to be like, oh, really, a triathlete, you know, is doing a pure paleo? But they're still going to be a little bit in disbelief because all they've been pitched is pasta, rice, starchy grain carbs, and so on and so forth. Any last words to kind of shut that door once and for all?
Hey, listen, they got to listen to the branched chain amino acid story. You know, humans don't just function on carbs only. Branched chain amino acid is a huge, huge story in terms of recovery from exercise, and one of the things that makes athletes stronger and fitter and perform better is the ability to recover from a workout, so that the next day's workout can be more intense and more grueling. And if you deny the concept of branched chain amino acids, then there's this entire window that you're completely denying. The other thing is the acid-base issue, and we've never talked about that, or we just hit upon it, but because athletes' diets are overloaded with processed foods and grains are net acid-yielding. One of the ways the body deals or copes with net acid production is through the amino acid glutamine. And glutamine is in the blood amino acid pool. And so the way in which the liver or the kidneys can excrete more acid is by utilizing glutamine and taking it out of that pool. Well, if we take glutamine out of the blood pool, then that's also a factor that has a huge effect upon total muscle mass. So we need to consider the entire picture. We need to consider acid-base balance. We need to consider the glycemic load. We need to consider branched chain amino acids. And finally, we need to consider immune function. And if you eat a diet that's overloaded in processed foods and grain, you're going to almost for certain have not meet the DRI for zinc, the daily recommended intake. And zinc is one of the most important elements for keeping our immune system functioning and to prevent us from having upper respiratory disease and problems. And so you're not going to get sufficient zinc on a typical athlete starch, rice, bread type diet. And so the best source of zinc are lean animal meats.
Well, Doctor, one of the things that you've mentioned on, and I wanted to, I'm glad you mentioned it because I wanted to ask you about it anyway, is this whole confusion over the glycemic index, and you gave an excellent example in the Paleo Diet for Athletes with regard to this confusion, and instead of thinking glycemic index, and I've read this before and definitely believe wholeheartedly in this other thinking, we should look at glycemic load. Can you just give an example of one fruit that is confused with
bad? There's two. I mean, like one is carrots. You know, carrots have a fairly high glycemic index, but a very low glycemic load. And watermelon's the same situation. I think in the South Beach diet, the guy that wrote that book is saying don't eat carrots and don't eat watermelon because they have high glycemic indices. Well, one of my colleagues is Jenny Brand Miller, who's appeared on many of our scientific papers. She's she's Mrs. Glycemic Index and Load. She's done it all. She's co-authored the International Table of Glycemic Indices and Glycemic Load. And, you know, we really need to consider the load. I think that's one of the critical issues here. So you can eat all the watermelon and all the carrots you want, and you're going to still get a real fairly low glycemic load. You can look at my book, and we give you the numbers. I don't have those on the top of my head. But
right.
Yeah, so it's the glycemic load that's more important. And the glycemic load is simply the glycemic index multiplied by the carbohydrate content of a serving of standard serving of food.
And where that confusion comes in is, you know, a standard serving is maybe, you know, one carrot or whatever.
Yeah.
But to get 50 usable grams of carbohydrates, which is what's used for the glycemic index, you've got to eat a lot.
Yeah.
Which is not a normal serving.
Yeah, so it's, and remember, too, that the glycemic index is not a, we view it as a number like you put fruit on a scale at the supermarket and you get a number, but it's more like a range because the way it's determined, it's not a single number. So there's,
right.
There's a lot of wiggle room in the whole idea of a glycemic index.
Well, not only that, but when you start combining foods, everything changes anyway.
That's right.
You don't normally eat just a carrot by itself.
That's right.
Normally you combine
it. What's important is the overall glycemic load and what the overall glycemic load does to the day-long insulin response. That's really what we're interested in.
A glycemic load, when if you're eating jujubes, is quite a bit higher than eating a carrot.
That's right.
Let's, for just a second, you had mentioned, too, what about the overall nutritional value on a 2,000-calorie intake, paleo, versus the food guide pyramid?
Oh, it blows it away in every regard. There's only two nutrients that it doesn't beat the food pyramid by an order of magnitude, and one is vitamin D, and the other is calcium. And Stone Age humans got their vitamin D from sunlight exposure. So if you don't go out and get a little sunlight exposure, you probably need to take some vitamin D on this. Calcium, as we've already mentioned, is a non-issue, particularly if you are getting higher protein and if you have about 30% of your energy from fruits and vegetables, you will be in calcium balance even though your DRI is lower than recommended values.
Yeah, you had already mentioned that the calcium balance is actually tipped toward an increase in calcium or net available calcium when you're eating more protein. Is that correct? Did I say that right?
That's right. And also, you don't lose as much calcium when you have a net base-yielding diet. So the only base-yielding foods are fruits and vegetables. And in the typical Western diet, we get less than 5% of our total energy from fruits and veggies. So if you up that to 35%, what it's going to do is it's going to counter the calciuresis from the typical net acid-yielding diet in the Western world.
How do you feel about a multivitamin, multimineral?
Well, I don't think that there's really any need to do a multivitamin, multimineral if you are eating pure paleo. But if you're eating the typical Western diet, you're guaranteed you're going to have a zinc insufficiency. 73% of the population doesn't meet the zinc requirement. And when we look at the DRIs, the way the DRIs, when we look at a population basis, what we do is we just look at the foods and we say, okay, the guy's eating so much cereal, so much this, so much that, how much zinc is in these foods? And then we total it all up and we say, okay, he's not meeting it. But what we really need to know is we need to look at the bioavailability of it. And if you eat a lot of whole wheat, even though it has zinc in it, it's virtually non-absorbable because it's bound to a substance called phytate. And similarly, if you were to eat a lean steak along with a glass of milk, you wouldn't get any of the zinc because calcium impairs zinc absorption. So when people go out and have their Big Mac and they put cheese on it, the zinc that's in the beef is not absorbed because of the calcium in the cheese.
Well, you know, Doc, the key here is for you and I to be able to help people to think and to get their mindset that Paleolithic eating is not punishment eating. That's just a key factor in making this more of a success for more people, because there's no question in my experience, and I know in your experience, but definitely in my experience in coaching thousands of people over the last 7 years, that when they go paleo, and even if they don't even if they don't go 85-15, but you know, a lot of the ones that go paleo will go even higher as far as a percentage, but when they go paleo, there's no overweight issue. You know, when they go paleo, there's no addiction issue. Those foods are just almost just outside the realm of being addiction foods.
That's right, and I think, you know, what I've seen anecdotally, I'm not a practitioner or a clinician. You know, I'm kind of a guy at a university setting that is pushing the pieces around on the chessboard. But what I've seen, I have, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people that write me and email me. And what I've seen is that when they go on paleo, certain little problems they have, it may be a stuffy nose and maybe getting up in the morning and they're stiff or their joints hurt or, you know, just these common day in and day out things that people live with throughout their lives, it goes away. And sometimes they don't even realize it goes away. And then when they go back and have these indiscretions and go out and pound down a bunch of donuts and whatever their food is,
right,
is that immediately they start to get the stuffy nose, the hurting joints, and they repeat this pattern enough to realize, okay, this is what's causing it. And I think they kind of change the way they view these their so-called reward foods anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, the proof is in the pudding. It's, you know, what I find is I have clients that will do paleo, have outstanding results, and then they have that, I always call it the sprinter mentality, where they bust the tape in 10 seconds to say, thank God I'm done, now I can go back to eating. They have the great weight loss success, they feel great, they do paleo, and then they go, oh, thank goodness I'm done, I made my goal, now I can go back to what's normal. And, of course, when they do that, if what's normal for them is the typical American Western diet, they also regain the weight. So it's definitely a project. It's definitely a mission of mine to help people get a better understanding of what this is, because it works.
That's right. You know, and David, this book was pitched by the first book was pitched by the editors as a weight loss book, but in reality, it certainly will help people that are overweight lose weight. In reality, it has nothing to do with it being a diet. This is a lifetime program of eating to maximize health benefits, and I think that's the way it needs to be looked at. If you look at something like an Atkins diet, where they say, okay, you have to limit your carbohydrates to 100 grams a day for the rest of your life, you know, when fresh strawberries and peaches come into season, it's like, my God, you mean I can only have a half a bowl?
Mm-hmm.
So that is really some of the shortcomings of those types of diets. And this is not a diet. If this is a fad diet, it's the world's oldest fad diet, because it's what humans have been eating for 2.5 million years. And what we've done is it doesn't require a charismatic individual. You don't have to have an Atkins. You don't have to have whoever pitching a diet, because after I'm long dead, what we've done is we've uncovered the way that humans are genetically programmed to eat and have optimal health. And so the cream will rise to the top, and it doesn't require, as I mentioned, any charismatic individual. It's what individuals will discover for themselves, because when you have the correct answer and it works, people will eventually glom onto it. We just got to get Oprah aware of it.
Absolutely. I love that. With that, I'm going to say thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to share your wisdom on this subject with me and my listeners. I really can't recommend highly enough that anyone listening purchase the Paleo Diet or the Paleo Diet for Athletes or both. And I know both are available on Amazon. Are they available anywhere else?
Sure, Barnes & Noble, or you can go to my website. You can get them through Amazon at my website, which is www.thepaleodiet.com.
Outstanding. Any last words or thoughts?
Hey, stay the course, David.
Thank you so much.
Alrighty.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. For more information on Club Lifestyle, the Leanest Lifestyle, or just to see what David Greenwald is up to now, visit my website at www.leanestlifestyle.com. That's www.leanestlifestyle.com. I look forward to seeing you there, and until next time, this is David Greenwald. Have a great day. Goodbye now.